Today's edition of the Derek Hunter Podcast is brought to you by Ancient Life Oil.
What is Full Spectrum CBD? Full Spectrum CBD is all the cannabinoids, which in turn gives you major effectiveness. CBD isolate is much less effective than Full Spectrum CBD. No herbicides, no pesticides, pure organic, non-GMO, Full Spectrum CBD. Where do you get the good stuff? At AncientLifeOil.com. That's AncientLifeOil.com. Buy CBD tinctures that work. That's AncientLifeOil.com.
Alrighty, hello again everyone and welcome to it. It's the Derek Hunter Podcast for the 28th day of July. How can I forget what month it is? It's sweaty. It could be any of 3 months. I'm Derek Hunter. I am your host. Welcome to the podcast, a special edition of the program today, an interview. Yeah, you know, it's mixed bag. Some of you email me and say, I love the interviews. And other of you say, I'd rather you not do any interviews ever. I think that mix is the way to go. When they can get a good interview, you go with the interview. And when there's a big news day, you go with the big news day. And you go with a mix of the two. And you got to have a mix of the two. And so on and so forth and such and things of that sort. Today's interview is with a guy called Michael Barnes. And you're probably sitting there going, who's Michael Barnes? Unless you work in law in Hollywood. You probably don't know. But you should know who Michael Barnes is now, because he is the writer, producer and director of the new documentary about Roger Ailes, which I watched 1.5 times last night. It's really good, really good. Called Man in the Arena. You know Roger Ailes. You know the story about Fox News, but you don't know really know the story of Roger Ailes. And this is the story of Roger Ailes' whole life. It's fascinating. You wonder, how do these people get to where they are? You always hear, this is what they did. You see the documentaries and the books about, this is what they did while they were at the top. I'm more interested in how you got to the top. I want to be at the top. I'm not at the top. I'm at the bottom. How do you get to the top? And this documentary lets you know exactly how Roger Ailes became Roger Ailes. It also doesn't shy away from controversy, so you don't have to worry about that. It's not some suck-up piece. It's just a depiction of what this man's life was and what led him to become the most powerful man in media, essentially. So it's really interesting. I highly recommend it. It's available on Amazon streaming and probably more streaming soon. It just literally came out yesterday. So I got a preview of it a couple days ago and I rewatched it again. I've seen it 1.5 times. It's excellent. But first, let me tell you about AncientLifeOil.com. If you're sitting around, you got the aches and pains, the stress, the anxiety, whatever it is that ails you, and if you're not having trouble, if you're having trouble sleeping or relaxing, I've got the solution for you. You go to AncientLifeOil.com. You choose your flavor and potency of the CBD oil. CBD oil, what is that? Look, it's a miracle is what it is. Google what CBD oil testimonials you can find out there and see what people are saying. And then talk to some friends. I bet you know people that you would have never suspected using CBD oil who use CBD oil. And you go, you know what? I'm going to try it. Sounds pretty good to me. That's when you go to AncientLifeOil.com. You choose your flavor. You choose your strength. And then you enter promo code Derek, D-E-R-E-K, at checkout. Click apply, you get free fast shipping on top of it. Great deals, all sorts of products there for your health. Wonderful, wonderful website. Great company, been supporting the podcast for a very long time. We appreciate the hell out of it. And you guys have been supporting them for a very long time, or they wouldn't have been here. So you go to AncientLifeOil.com, promo code Derek, click apply, get free fast shipping. And then, you know, you'll thank me for it. It really does work. It's amazing. I don't know how, but it does. Okay, we'll get to the Michael Barnes interview. Fascinating guy. Corporate lawyer out in Hollywood, brokered a whole bunch of deals. He was telling me all the deals that he had brokered, including buying several studios. So it's like big, big time connected guy. And he decided that he was going to make a movie, a documentary about Roger Ailes and couldn't find anybody to direct it. And then he said, you know what? People told him, you direct it. And thought that was crazy. And he did it. And he did a damn fine job of it. Highly, highly recommend it. Before we get to that, though, got one more bit of business. The Trump campaign has a special offer just for you. President Trump really wants to give you a signed 2020 Make America Great Again hat. How awesome would that be? He wants to make sure the lucky winner is one of his top supporters like you. So be sure to enter soon because this is an opportunity you do not want to miss. The offer is only going to a select group of supporters and you're one of them. All you have to do is text my name, Derek, D-E-R-E-K, to 88022 today for your chance to win a signed 2020 Make America Great Again hat and own a piece of history. That's it. Again, it's D-E-R-E-K to 88022 to enter to win this contest and join President Trump in the fight to keep America great for four more years. And Lord knows we need that. This was paid for by Donald J. Trump for President Incorporated. So without any further ado, here is the director of the documentary, great documentary, Man in the Arena, Michael Barnes.
We've already had the show, and we're now in the middle of the show to the point of the interview. I told you I teased it. Now he's here. He's the writer, director, producer of the Man in the Arena, a new documentary on Roger Ailes, which is really fascinating. I watched it 1.5 times last night, once by myself and a half time with my wife, and then it was like 1 o'clock in the morning and time to go to bed. It's really excellent. I highly recommend it. Michael Barnes, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Cool. First of all, congratulations on the documentary. It's getting a lot of press, a lot of buzz. But you, before we get into the movie itself and the story of Roger Ailes, and this isn't a story of the fall of Roger Ailes, although that's part of it. It's a story of Roger Ailes, the whole picture, the whole life. You were a corporate lawyer. Your IMDb page has a lot of hits, but it's all various legal work up there. This is your first time writing and directing. Why did you make that transition? What brought you about to go to the, I guess not the other side of the camera, but the other side of the studio?
Thanks, Derek. It's an interesting story. The short version of it is I knew Roger kind of tangentially and was, after he died, had reached out to the family and asked if they were going to do a documentary on Roger. And I had intended just to do what I normally do, which is to executive produce or to have some involvement from the executive suite. But as I delved into the details of Roger's life and how extraordinary his life had been, which I had not known previously, I was around a few filmmakers who, frankly, I was trying to hire as directors, saying, hey, would you like to direct this? And finally, one of them, a filmmaker, just said, why don't you direct? I said, I'm not a director. I don't know how to turn on a camera. And he just said, silly Michael. It's not what a director does. And I looked at one of my producers and said, what does he mean? And they both just said, you should direct this movie. And, it took a few weeks for me to decide to do it. But it was not my intention when I started out to write and direct the movie. I was just doing what I normally did, which was to be a film executive lawyer. So a very inauspicious beginning for my involvement in my directorial debut.
Is this something you think you want to do again, or is this something where you're like, well, I survived that?
That's a really good question, and I unfortunately don't have a good answer for it, and I realize part of it is the following. We kept this film secret. We did it. And normally in Hollywood, or other film production, while you're making the film, you're out there blasting your credentials as loudly as possible, trying to hook up your next gig. So the entire team, we were not doing that. We were keeping this under wraps. Accordingly, I have a couple people who've approached me on separate things, but we didn't use this film to go decide to get our next film or the third or the fourth or the fifth one. So I'm sort of scratching my head like, well, that's something I'd do again. possibly, and some of my producers very much want to do more of these. Let's see what the reception is. Maybe
why did you keep it secret? Because I got an email last week from a friend of mine who works in PRs, and I got something that might interest you on the down low. And she sent me a detailed thing and a link and a password and a secret thing. I had to draw blood and give it to watch the documentary. And like, it did seem like, don't tell anybody about this. Don't spread the word. Don't, this isn't for you to my wife produces radio. Like, don't tell anybody. And why was it so secretive?
A couple of reasons. And, you know, from my perspective, the first was there were three other projects about Roger Ailes that were planned and coming to market. There was a documentary a year and a half ago, I don't think anybody watched, but it was very, very critical of Roger, very much an agenda-based piece. Then, of course, there was a Showtime miniseries last summer, which I think did okay. Did poorly at first, and then I think it picked up, but certainly had some star power in it. Then, of course, there was the
Bombshell movie.
Yeah, the Bombshell, you know, which was kind of an award bait movie with a lot of Hollywood power in it that came out late last year. And it was pretty much a sensationalized, fictionalized, they used characters that didn't exist, etc. But those were three, you know, a lot of money, a lot of Hollywood muscle behind those, at least two of those productions, and certainly the third one, the documentary, had some backing. And we realized that if we announced that we were doing a documentary about Roger, we would have all three of those gun batteries turned on us, because that would be part of their marketing. At least we thought it would be. And that we're better off just to not let anyone know what we're doing, quietly go to the primary sources, the people who knew Roger, the people who Roger elected, the actual media, the underlying tapes and audio of Roger, and use those. So not only did we not want to have kind of Roger's enemies turn their guns on us, we thought it might scare away some of our interviewees and our primary sources if suddenly they were reading about it every day, or you know, once a week there was a hit piece on our production. You know, they probably wonder how long until those hit pieces turn on me if I stand up and tell the real story or the story that I know about Roger. So it's sort of defensive in nature. Whether that was a good decision or not, I guess history will record. But that's originally why we decided to go, you know, stealth on this.
And we you got the big names. You got the Rush Limbaugh, the Rudy Giuliani. You got Roger Ailes' wife. Was there anybody you couldn't get that you wanted to get that just wouldn't participate?
Yes, there were. There's two. The wouldn't participate drops into a couple of categories. The first category are those who said, lose my number, don't ever call me again. That was a very tiny category. More, it was the second category, which were pretty much people who still work at Fox. And again, we wanted to not ever let word of this leak out, but I talked to a number of people currently employed at Fox who said, bravo, I can't help you because I'll lose my job, or the environment here is such that I just can't, you know, I'd have to get approval from Fox corporate for any appearance like this. They'll never approve it. Any number of bona fide reasons why they just would not be able to, you know, step forward and do anything publicly. And some of those persons nonetheless helped me offline with some confirmation, some backing, some stories. I give them credit at the end of the movie, you know, the 10 or so people who anonymously gave me a lot of insight to help understand Roger and what he was about. But so I did. So again, we had very few said no, lose my number, but rather it was the Fox people who just contractually or as a matter of office politics or the like weren't able to step up and publicly participate.
Well, let me ask you, let's get into the movie itself. There is the the bombshell and the loudest voice in the room. I didn't see the other documentary, but the bombshell and loudest voice in the room focus on Fox News and Roger at Fox and Roger as Fox in many ways. Your documentary is, this is your life. This is his whole story. Roger, you think of a guy who made a fortune, powerful guy, one of the most powerful men in the country, in the world. He started off a nobody in a almost a fake home, because as soon as he got out of high school and went to college, his parents split up and went their separate ways. It was one of those, we're waiting until the kids leave the house before we get divorced. But Roger grows up in a small town in Ohio, the wrong side of the tracks, not family with no money, struggling. And he's a hemophiliac, which I don't know what the life expectancy of a hemophiliac is, but 1940, it couldn't have been very long. Talk a little bit about young Roger and how he became, the things that formed him into what he became.
That's a really good question, and it's one of the things that, the revelations that I came across early on that piqued my interest in Roger, and that's that he was a hemophiliac. He was born in 1940, and as you mentioned, his life expectancy was single digits. He should not have lived past age 10 from the medical literature that I've read back then. It's called Factor K or something, whatever is the drug, the wonder drug that helps hemophiliacs nowadays. They didn't have that. So there's additional literature out there over the past decades about the psychological profile of hemophiliac kids, particularly boys, that they become daring, risk takers, even called daredevils. Ironically, in all of this, I found an old Marcus Welby television episode from the late 60s or early 70s that addressed this exact situation. And it was Steven Spielberg's television directorial debut. He directed a Marcus Welby episode about a hemophiliac kid who's out there kind of daredevil. And that was instructive, not only to learn that, but to realize that this had been a noted psychological profile in decades past of kids with hemophilia. And it did in many ways match and shape Roger's youth. Roger's brother ended up being a doctor. So when I was able to get his brother to do an interview, his brother talked about that and how that shaped, Roger's life when he was young. And as we talked about quite a bit in the film, Roger's dad was worried that, Roger was worried that he'd be, the crippled little kid who was afraid to do anything.
Well, there's an extraordinary story in the documentary of when he was 7 or 8 and he fell and he bit his tongue. See, most people don't know what a hemophiliac is, but Roger Ailes nearly died from biting his tongue, like a small cut. You bleed because it just won't coagulate. It won't heal. And his father, the doctors in, was it Warren, Ohio, said, pretty much get ready. He's about to die because he's going to bleed to death.
Yeah, your kid's going to bleed out. Nothing we can do.
And father wouldn't take that. Threw him in the car, wrapped him up as he was bleeding all over the place, I imagine, and drove to Cleveland. And tell about the sort of conga line, the train of people from Warren, Ohio, who drove up to give blood to make sure that Roger Ailes didn't bleed out.
Yeah. Well, that's, again, that was one of the extraordinary stories that his brother recounted for us, that his father, who was a factory worker at an auto factory, and through the bleeding Roger in the back seat, we were trying to identify what car it was. We think it was what year it was, but a late 1940s car, and did the 60-mile drive speeding, got arrested along the way. Roger's father said, "Look what I got in the back seat here. That's why I'm speeding." He was awarded with a police escort into Cleveland to get got him to the hospital on time. And apparently, whatever technology they had at Cleveland was better than what they had at the local hospital in Warren. And Roger's father then went to back to his the guys who worked on his shift and at the factory. And in their off hours, they would daisy chain themselves to drive up to Cleveland and give blood, because I think one of the techniques was just to keep pumping the kid full of blood when they're bleeding out. So, you know, Roger, he talks about that, because we have audio tapes of Roger telling that story, as well as his brother telling that story. And that was a very, as Roger explains in the film, in his own words, he explains, it was a very telling moment for him to see his dad, didn't say a whole lot, kind of quiet guy, but to see that, you know, talk is talk, but you know, his dad was walking the walk. It was the deeds that mattered. And by his dad going to those extraordinary efforts, you know, to get the friends involved, to drive an hour away, you know, to pump out blood to save, you know, Roger's life. He's a scared kid sitting in the hospital bed. It was a lasting impression on Roger. For, you know, anyways, we explained the movie. And Roger explains and his brother explains. So yeah, very interesting formative events with Roger and his father, his hemophilia back in the 19, you know, really right after the war.
And he then graduates high school, joins our, I mean, this is who Roger was apparently, and as part of that sort of daredevil attitude is he wanted to join the military, even as a hemophiliac, which realistic, if biting your tongue can almost kill you, then falling down and cutting yourself or having a subdural hematoma bleeding under the skin could also kill you. But he wanted to join. He wanted to serve the country. Country was always a part of him. He faked his medical records. He doctored his medical records so that he could join the ROTC for the Air Force rather than the Army, because he figured if on a hike he fell and started bleeding, then the jig would be up. But in the Air Force, it'd be easier to hide. They eventually found out. But the idea that this guy wanted to serve his country so badly that he was willing to fake his medical records tells you something about him, doesn't it?
Absolutely. It wasn't just, and it wasn't a casual faking. He plotted it. He wanted to be an Army general. His brother, in the interview in the film, his brother tells the story about, you know, Roger just voraciously reading stories about military history and military heroes, and he wanted to be an Army general, like General Patton. And he realized the hemophilia, there's no way he was going to be allowed into the Army for the reasons you just mentioned. you have flat feet, you're out. You have hemophilia, you're out. So he thought, well, maybe if I'm up in the airplane, I won't put anybody at risk, because I won't be subject to those everyday injuries. So how am I going to do that? So he devised a plan and, you know, somehow got himself checked into the local hospital, whether he had a cold or whatever it was. And Roger, in his own voice, tells the story about going to the file cabinet and getting rid of the reference to hemophilia on his, on his medical records, so that he would then be able to pass the whatever the medical exam was for the Air Force ROTC. And then, of course, as life would have it, a surprise medical, he got busted. And it happened at a time of his life where it was just devastating for him. Because it was his life's dream. That's what he wanted to do with his life, is to be, you know, in the Air Force. And along with a couple other things that happened simultaneous with that, you know, he was just knocked flat on his back.
Let me ask you this, Michael. You knew Roger Ailes, the man, near the end of his life. You knew him. You spent some time, a lot of time with him. You had many conversations with him. I imagine you got to hear some of these stories firsthand, or at least the general gist of them firsthand. When putting this documentary together, speaking to all the people that you did, going through the archives that you did, what did you find is the biggest surprising thing that you discovered about Roger that, as somebody who knew him, didn't know before?
Yeah, well, that's a tough question to answer. I knew Roger, but I wasn't in his inner circle. So
right.
a lot of what I was learning from recorded tapes and just doing publicly available research was all new to me. So, but I think the hemophilia was the real, that was the real revelation for me, because Roger didn't broadcast that. He didn't project himself as a victim in any way, and I think people will be very surprised to learn that he had hemophilia, which led to, you know, medical complications during his life. That's probably the one that just, you know, in that Johnny Carson moment of saying, wow, I did not know that, that was the one that that hit me. I know when he was working on, I believe it was the Mike Douglas show in the Nixon campaign, he decided to go skydiving as a hemophiliac, and he landed wrong. And he continued working for the next 36 hours with blood rushing out of his leg. And he just indomitably just kind of pretended it wasn't happening. And again, I don't think normal people do that.
No, it's kind of funny. The more seemingly tight our grip is on life, the more cautious we are. And the people who have the most to lose through the simplest of things seem to, in many ways, live it to the fullest. And that was kind of what Roger did, is like, I could go at any time, so I'm going to go balls to the wall here. And from college, he's a radio DJ. Who'd have thought, the Mike Douglas show, was that out of Cleveland?
It was. Mike Douglas show, if you remember, well, not that you remember, but if you know your television history, back then, you know, television networks were just kind of being strung together.
All right, the Dick Clark show, whatever, was out of Philadelphia, I forgot. You know, you don't think of these major shows that everybody knows about still today that were part of the zeitgeist of the moment.
Sure.
They were from anywhere.
They were afternoon talk shows produced at local television stations, and this was one that was put together in Cleveland, and it was syndicated, you know, called syndicated, meaning they would take the tapes and syndicate them and sell them to other you know, to other television stations around the country, whether they were in the network or otherwise. So that's where the Mike Douglas show in glorious black and white had its inauspicious beginnings. And Roger was a gopher, as he tells the story, and as we tell the story in the movie, Man in the Arena. He was just a gopher, hired for, you know, less than minimum wage to, as he said, sweep out the storeroom and do whatever that local television station needed. But one thing they were doing was broadcasting this new show called The Mike Douglas Show, and it took off. Several years later, it did move to Philadelphia. But that's how he started in Cleveland.
And what I found amazing and is a great lesson for anybody trying to get ahead, especially when you start off early, is the Get Ailes story.
Yes.
Because he goes, in just a few short years, goes from the guy who'd go get coffee and pick up guests from the airport to the guy running the show as executive producer. And he asks the guy running the show, owns the show or whatever, why me? Like, how did that happen? And he said, anytime there was a problem, everybody would say, well, get Ailes to do it, because he busted his ass. And that's sort of the philosophy that I have of, you might have to work for free at something. It's a philosophy behind this show. You might have to work for free for a while, but it's going to pay off in the long run if you do it well, if you can do it well. And that's what Roger Ailes sort of did his whole life. It's like, all right, I'll do here, but you're going to notice me, and you're going to pay attention to me, because I'm going to make it so you can't not pay attention.
Exactly. And also that time in the late 40s and the 1950s, remember, these technologies were brand new. Remember when you couldn't get your VHS recorder to work? Remember when you couldn't get your dial-up modem to connect to the internet? Back then, television, it was new. And it was there was the art form of radio, which was older. Roger had been a radio disc jockey, and he had, you know, in college, and he'd been the student manager of the college station, which meant he knew how to turn on the machines, he knew how to fix the microphones, he knew how to do A, B, C, and D. He then had a summer job at a small television station in West Virginia during college. So he learned, again, in summer internship, how to turn on the camera, how to, you know, work at 3 in the morning. So he knew things from the ground up. And as many people have told me, and as I learned about Roger doing the documentary, that's what people would say, is Roger knew every job in the radio studio and the television studio, because he'd done them. He'd swept the floors, he'd turned on the camera, he'd fixed the microphones, and that made him not only he was willing to work hard, but he was willing to roll up his sleeves and do the work. That's where he started. And that led to him being known as a get-it-done guy, and as we show in the film, Get Ailes was the kind of the watchword for Roger. Sort of knows how to fix everything, or certainly will have a good approach for it.
One of the things about the Mike Douglas show is, if you weren't alive then, like I wasn't alive then, you see all of these big stars and people like, I don't know what the Mike Douglas show was. It's kind of like the Merv Griffin show. I know what it was, but I never saw it. You had shows with Martin Luther King. You had Malcolm X on there. These are people, you know, that Roger was meeting. And one of the people that he met was Richard Nixon, who was thinking about running for president in 1968. And it's a hilarious story when he turns, as people were saying, yeah, you don't have to worry about being good on TV. TV, blah, blah, blah. TV's fad. And Roger basically turns to him and says, if you don't learn how to be good on TV, if you're not good on TV, you're going to lose again. Just basically kind of just says what probably everybody on the payroll knew, but they were on the payroll and they weren't about to say it. And that sort of led Roger into the world of politics, right?
Absolutely. Roger, it was an offhand conversation, I think, in what we call the green room before the show. And Roger was just talking to this guy. Running for president. Roger did know that he lost the presidency in 1960 to John F. Kennedy. He knew that he lost the governorship of California. And so he knew the guy he'd lost a couple times. But so as Richard Nixon said, oh, you know, this TV thing, it's a gimmick. Roger just spoke his mind and sort of schooled Richard Nixon. And a couple days later, Roger got a phone call from was Nixon's campaign manager, who said, hey, we're putting together a team. The candidate thinks maybe you're the guy to do television for him. and Roger, as we show in the film, why would any sane person who's 25, 26 years old, has an Emmy on the wall, as the showrunner of what I think at the time was the most popular talk show in America, had more viewers than Johnny Carson, why would you leave that gig to go do television for a political candidate? It seems like a really poor career path choice to make. And so we explain in the film, you know, what the factors were, you know, in Roger doing that, trying it. But it began with that offhanded, that chance encounter you mentioned between Richard Nixon and Roger Ailes, where Roger
From there, there's a lot of detail that I don't want to go into just because I want people to watch the movie. But it goes to a wildly successful victory in 1968 for Richard Nixon, due in large part to Roger's involvement and coaching and ideas. To 1972, they decide the Nixon campaign doesn't want him, which doesn't make any sense to me, that you would, you're supposed to dance with the girl who brung you. You should be... you know, you won last time with this team. Why do you think Nixon and his team went with somebody else for TV?
You know, we have Roger in his own voice telling, you know, the reason why he thinks it happened, which was a very, you know, in some ways a generic reason, that you take chances. You know, when you're an outsider and you're an underdog and it gets you in there, but once you're in there, you become surrounded by people. I don't want to say people who are more corporate-y, the people who have a more corporate outlook, and they don't necessarily, as Roger says, they don't want the crazy guy leading the re-election television campaign. And so that was just a good generic reason as to why Roger, his particular skill set, which was to be very creative, very outside the box, and as he was in the 68 election, by creating this new thing, which was Richard Nixon standing right in front of the voters on live television for an hour and a half, fielding questions. It was a little risky, and so he was edged aside. We found some other materials in presidential libraries and otherwise that hinted at just kind of turf warfare going on inside the White House, which I think would be going on in any administration. But it was great to have Roger in his own voice tell us why, you know, from his perspective, why he left and did not continue to handle the campaign of Richard Nixon in 1972, which, as people who know history will know, that was 9 months away from the Watergate scandal.
Yeah, it's probably a better thing to. It's like getting off the Titanic at the last stop in Ireland before they head west. Then he goes. He works for the Reagan campaign in 1984, helps Reagan recover from a disastrous debate performance in the first debate, helps George W. Bush in 1988 win the White House there, Dukakis in the field of opportunity that he presented to people. But all throughout this, Roger is, there's lag time between campaigns. Sure. Roger's running an ad company. He's not really working in television anymore. Was it because that he went and worked for Republicans? Why wasn't he? Because I would think that the guy who produced the Mike Douglas show would kind of be a semi-desirable commodity. Sure. In Hollywood.
Well, that's, you know, we show that in the film, and Roger talks about, you know, you have your ups and you have your downs, and so long as you're not dead, you got a chance. And, you know, when early in his life, we talked about hemophilia and, you know, his family home just disintegrating because of the divorce of his parents, his best friend dying, you know, all concurrently, you know, Roger was just flat on his back in a low moment. He had another low moment right after Watergate. It didn't matter that he had nothing to do with Watergate. He was tainted by it. He was forever known as a guy who had, you know, elected or helped elect Richard Nixon, who was the guy thrown out from Watergate. So the 1970s were, he was in the wilderness. And that's one of the points of the movie, that he's flat on his back. It doesn't matter that he had successfully done these two things. He was persona non grata because no one would touch a Watergate guy or someone who they thought was a Watergate guy with a 10-foot pole. So he produced plays successfully, Broadway plays. He did a documentary, as we show with Robert F. Kennedy Jr. He did a nature documentary. And he did some consulting, corporate consulting. And then, you know, we show that transition of how he dealt with his time in the wilderness, that by 1980, he was back starting to produce television. He's a television director, so he was producing television commercials and media consulting for Republican candidates. And man, did he have a decade. The 1980s were a decade.
I had no idea that he was instrumental in getting somebody like Mitch McConnell and Al D'Amato elected.
What's incredible about those two particular cases, which we have Majority Leader McConnell, or Senate Majority Leader McConnell on tape telling the story, and we have a couple others talking about it, but Roger had these long shot clients. Mitch McConnell was down, 45 points. No one knew who he was. D'Amato was down 42 points. I mean, they were hopeless. And Roger would tell them, no, it's not hopeless. Let me show you what we're going to do. And we tell kind of the incredible story of these absolute long shot cases that were never going to get elected. But Roger came in and did Roger's craftsmanship. And they won. And it's a story people just don't know or they've forgotten. So we show that, and it shows that Roger had been a big deal in the 60s and then reinvented himself and was now the king of the hill in the 1980s in political consulting, such that we show the motion picture that was basically modeled after Roger. It was released in the 1980s that people have just forgotten about. All of this was years before Fox News was ever an inkling in anyone's heart.
Well, after the 88 campaign and in the early 90s, Roger was, and this is a thing I knew, but will shock a lot of viewers, is that he was brought in to run CNBC,
yes.
Which, you know, you think now CNBC, MSNBC, they curse the name Roger Ailes' existence, but they wouldn't exist without him, because not only did he start or bring CNBC some ratings, some viewers, but he also started what became MSNBC.
Absolutely.
Which has to kill them over there right now. But it's a fascinating story because there was that, was it America's Talking or whatever?
Yes.
I don't remember that. I was always a big news consumer. I have no memory of that. Talk sure. a little bit about his yeah. work on MSN in NBC's world.
Roger did not stay on with the 92 Bush campaign, and we have Vice President Quayle, who's running mate in that election, talking about that and the effect of Roger's non-participation in the 92 campaign. They lost, and Dan Quayle tells the story. But, again, Roger now has his third period in the wilderness. He's, what is he going to do? And he was being set up to produce some Hollywood shows, and he couldn't get in. There were already too many producers on a show. So he got offered a consolation prize, which Roger talks about in the film, which is, hey, we just merged a couple of companies together. We've got this channel called CNBC. You know, we don't know what we're going to do with it. Are we going to shut it down? Maybe you can figure something out. So Roger somewhat reluctantly takes that CEO position. He thought he was going to be the showrunner for Jay Leno, but he's in New Jersey running a channel no one's ever seen. I think it was called People's Financial Network or something like that at the time. And Roger turned it into a hit. Well, he had an amazing success with it because it became financial news during the day and then talk news at night, kind of like talk radio was becoming popular. And that was called CNBC, and it launched the careers, or continued the careers, of many, many talk show hosts and commentators. Meanwhile, they spun off, they started up using their cable carriage, a new channel called America's Talking, which Roger would later say that was the beta test of Fox and Friends. And if you go back and watch those shows, which were very quirky, but those were the two networks. Roger programmed every show of both networks. So he was running two networks to be the 94-95 period. And he had time to have his own talk show on America's Talking, which was called...
So that was fascinating, watching Roger Ailes conduct interviews with people who, nowadays you don't get any liberals on Fox and barely any, and you don't get any conservatives or barely any on MSNBC or CNN. But he's friends with Robert Kennedy. He was cordial with all these people, liberals, hardcore liberals that you know today. He couldn't, they got along. It's sort of a novelty looking at that, my God, people who disagree being cordial to one another.
And it's a really good point. And it was one of the kind of second revelations that I had that wanted me to make this movie is, isn't that kind of what we thought the First Amendment was about? The Norman Rockwell painting where people get in a room and chat a little bit and raise their hand and kind of debate things cordially. That show, there was 200 or 300 episodes of Roger's talk show back in the 90s. That's the epitome of what we like to think the First Amendment and freedom of speech is and getting together to work out problems. That's not what we have today. But boy, it's just interesting to see that when Roger was running that show, that you had entertainers and politicians from all stripes would come on and say what they thought. Roger would question them, they'd chat back and forth, and I think you'd come away from the episodes, I've watched them all, you'd come away from the episodes saying, wow, that's really cool. I don't agree with that guy, but that was a really good point he made. And there's something that's been lost, and I think that show was maybe the high water mark in America where that type of public behavior press participation was still of that kind. And
it really has been lost, and sadly it started off that way on Fox. I think that's kind of been lost there. But then MSNBC is announced. Roger, the video that you have of him in the movie announced or on his last day as CEO of CNBC right before the launch of MSNBC. Was he forced out of MSNBC and CNBC, or did he choose to leave? It sounded like he didn't really choose to leave.
He had a key man clause, an exit, that he was had the right to run the station group, and in other words, the lines of reporting. And when Microsoft and NBC decided to joint venture and change the format of America's Talking, they also changed the organizational structure. So Roger was losing a division or two. And that was enough to violate his contract. He said, look, and as he says in the film, he said, look, I got to do it my way because I'm being held accountable for the success of this. So if I don't get to do it my way with people reporting to me, then I'm not going to do it. And that's why. So he chose to leave, but also, you know, they reorganized, so he had lost a division.
So again, he goes into the wilderness. And what I didn't know was that Rupert Murdoch had been looking to get into the cable news business for a while and had some false starts in getting into it, apparently. But then he met Roger Ailes and basically said, here's a big check. Roger insisted on complete control, and you've got 9 months to birth a network, a full network with 24 hours of programming from nothing.
That's the fascinating thing that has just been lost down the memory hole. Fox News, the idea of it, you know, or a cable channel, didn't start necessarily with Roger News, with Roger Ailes stepping in. News Corp had been trying for 3 or 5 years to launch a cable news channel. Rupert Murdoch wanted to have that asset in the United States because he'd been knocking on the door to get into the United States markets, and he just couldn't. And three executives had previously been the CEO of something called Fox News. Of course, there was no Fox News. They weren't able to launch it. But Roger was, it might have been the fourth person brought in. And Matt, you know, almost as if by magic, 9 months later, Fox News is on the air. And Peter Robinson, you know, in an interview that we include in our film, walks Roger through that, saying, what was this magic formula that what had been tried for years unsuccessfully suddenly came together? And as Roger points out, it was the combination of Roger Ailes and Rupert. They were the magic combination. Again, I'll note, because it's similar to what Roger had done at CNBC. Roger said, he told Rupert, I'll do it and I'll get it done, but we're doing it my way. I'm not going to answer to committees. I'm not going to have your guys from Australia, you know, who don't believe in this project, I'm not going to answer to them. You back me, we'll get somebody else. So that's one of the untold stories, is Rupert had faith in Roger. And Roger, he was going to be held accountable for it. He wanted the authority. And the rest is history, isn't it?
Well, they did it. They got launched. And it was, you know, it was struggling, as anything would when you just start up. Then 9/11 happens, and something strange happened. Since, what is it, October of 2001 until today, they've been the number one cable news channel in the country. What was it that differentiated? But now we look at it and like, well, you know, Pumpernickel is Fox's Pumpernickel, MSNBC is wheat bread, and CNN is, you know, white bread or whatever. They're completely different types of bread. Sure. They weren't really all that different back then. What was it about Fox News that drew the audience, you think, after 9/11?
You know, it's, I'm sure articles and books and doctoral theses have been written on this. But remember, CNN was a 17-year monopoly in cable news. They were a 999-pound gorilla in the room. And you had, 2,500 employees or 4,000 employees worldwide, something like that. And then Microsoft and NBC decided to throw their collective assets into the ring, and that was called MSNBC, but they were also a startup. But again, billion-dollar balance sheets, hundreds if not thousands of employees, and infrastructure of NBC News behind it. And then there was Fox News, which had no employees, no studios, no carriage. So it was really the first 5 years of Fox News' existence that they weren't even really on TV. They were acquiring cable space, cable channels, one by one, negotiating getting on the air. And that's a whole different story. But right about the time of 9/11, as well as the contested 2000 election, Fox News was actually starting to be available in homes. So you have this confluence of the 2000 election, with people people running to see the cable news every day to see what was going on in the recount in Florida, et cetera. And then a year later, you had 9/11 happen, where the appetite collectively for cable news just went up. And by then, Bill O'Reilly explains this in our film, by then, people were tuning in and they'd stumble across Fox. And the story of Fox News is, despite all those advantages that CNN had as a monopoly, owning the entire industry, and all those advantages that MSNBC had, being NBC, people, a good amount of people, found Fox News and they stayed there. They decided that was their channel. And you see that in the numbers. I think Greta Van Susteren points out in the quarter after 9/11, Fox News went from being an entity people didn't even know existed to being the ratings leader, and soon thereafter had more viewers than the other cable channels combined. It's an incredible story that people forget about.
And it
was all Roger Ailes.
It really is, and it leads to all the slings and arrows against Roger. And one thing that I forget who it is in the movie points out, but it's an excellent point. It might have been just a Greg Gutfeld clip that you played, but it was like they're dominating, they're winning. They have this model that is different from the other models. You would think that one of the other two networks would go, maybe there's some of that pie we could steal if we just do a little bit of this, that, or the other thing. But they didn't. They won't. Instead, Roger tells a hilarious story of how he's tweaking the on-screen graphics and during a live broadcast and watching CNN respond in real time by tweaking their on-screen graphics the same way, as if people are only tuning in for the graphics.
Absolutely. Because Roger says, you know, he gets criticized, but simultaneously copied for what he was doing at Fox. And just as he had done at CNBC and America's Talking, he was programming everything. Not programming the words, but he was programming the look and feel, the time slots, etc. And at the same time, his competitors were declaring him to be, you know, evil or you know, a joke. They were copying him. And again, therein lies one of the ironies of the rise of Fox.
So then he has an unprecedented almost 20-year run at Fox. And then we all know the story from there, the stories of sexual harassment. You don't shy away from that. You actually interview Roger's wife in the documentary. It's addressed head on. But in general, if the I don't know the full allegations and legal reasons prevented you from disclosing everything because of Roger's estate and what have you. But if that had happened, not even earlier, but if that had happened 5 years after, A, Roger probably would have retired by then. But B, do you think because it happened when it happened at the heart of the Me Too movement, that it was simply assumed to be true? And B, they hated Roger anyway, so the other media outlets, so they made it into a bigger story and it was just opportunity meeting timing?
You know, we addressed that in the movie. Again, the movie is not a Me Too movie.
No. I mean,
Roger really was kind of predated the Me Too movement, but the Me Too movement, you know, very much became a thing and still is a thing. So Roger's story gets conflated with the Me Too, with, you know, we think of Harvey Weinstein and, you know, criminal behavior. We've all read the stories, et cetera. But I think Roger's story was conflated with Me Too. And for the reasons we point out in the film, it was a perfect storm, truly a perfect storm. One of the, and people will have their opinions well-founded on both sides or all sides, that perhaps the environment at Fox was a hostile environment. Perhaps a lot of this was made up out of whole cloth or something in between. But I think the point we make in the film is one side of the story was told publicly and echoed publicly. And one of the big points, the driving point of this film, going over, I mean, generationally, over a number of decades, is one of the greatest engines for truth, as we say as lawyers, is cross-examination. But in a bigger sense, the greatest engine for truth truth is hearing both sides. That's why we have the First Amendment. That's why we have freedom of the press. Because there's never been invented a better engine of truth telling. So when you're in any situation, whether it's Rogers having taken Richard Nixon directly to the voters in live broadcasts, whether it's Roger having done the same thing with George Bush in his re-election to bypass what he thought was a hostile press, or in the case of Fox News, which was just the simple proposition Roger made, was how about if I have both sides in my commentary? We'll have liberals and conservatives. It makes for good television. But those are how you move towards truth. Let people see both sides if they want to, and that you move closer to the truth. If you don't have that construct, you start to look like propaganda. That's what the Soviets do. That's what East Germany did. That's what Venezuela does. And regardless of which side you take on an issue, or whether you think someone's full of it, or that guy's lying, or I believe her, or I don't believe her, or I believe him, you know, hearing both sides is the fundamental premise and foundation. And that's the bias of this film, is that's my viewpoint, and I think that's Roger was an agent of that for decades. And we show why we think that's important, and his part in the where angels fear to tread, the very difficult road in life sometimes for people who uphold one of those great bundles of civil rights.
So, I got to tell you, there's a lot more in this documentary. The Dan Rather stuff is gold and genius. And you see how, in many ways, throughout all of this, Roger Ailes is playing chess while everybody else is playing marbles, not even checkers. And watching Dan Rather not know what hit him in that famous interview with George Bush, George H.W. Bush, when he thought he was going to really clobber him, was absolutely brilliant. Now, Michael Barnes, before we wrap up here, I got to ask you, you produced, wrote, and directed a movie, a documentary about Roger Ailes that doesn't put horns on his body and make him out to be a devil. You also are a lawyer who works out in Hollywood. Everybody thinks of Hollywood as this left-wing bastion. Have you gotten any, I mean, it's only just been sort of released on the world, but have you gotten any blowback, or have you fear any blowback from people you work with at your regular job? You're thinking, oh, shit, this is going to be problematic?
You know, it's a really good question, and I guess my answer is I'll find out. What I do for a living for 30-some years, which is put together movies and financing and that, I don't rely on people having dinner and we all agree in the echo chamber on political issues. Matter of fact, a lot of my friends, I'm right of center, I think you call me, in Iowa, where I'm from. I'm thought of as kind of a left-wing California pinko. Out here in California, I'm thought of as, you know, some reactionary guy from Iowa. You know, both sides kind of think I'm a little bit odd. But I get invited to dinner parties because people say I'm interesting. So long as I'm interesting and honest, I think what I do in my day job will continue. But look, haters gonna hate, you know what they say. And in the environment we're in this world, sure. And as Roger points out in the movie, if speaking this kind of truth, or at least trying to, means that 30 or 40% of the people in the country automatically hate you tomorrow. Okay, well, I guess that means I did okay in making a movie that was that hit a nerve. So we'll see. So I don't have a good answer to your question, but I'm not fearing it. But we'll see.
Good. That's the only way you can do it, is just to do it and say, well, the chips are going to fall where they may. How can people watch Man in the Arena?
The best way is go to the website maninthearena.com. maninthearena.com, and as the digital platforms are added, it will take you to all the links, but right now it's on Amazon, so you'll click on Man in the Arena, it'll take you right to the link. It's that wonderful, one or two clicks, and you can watch it right now. Because of COVID and the nation's theaters shutting down, we've had to pivot, on how this movie gets taken out, but you know, for people to see. But right now, clicking and watching it in your living room is how you do it. And go to manoftheArena.com is where you'll find it.
It works. I can vouch for it 1.5 times. Lastly, as we let you go, Michael Barnes, explain the title. It's a great quote from Teddy Roosevelt.
Yeah. Man in the Arena was a speech given 100 years ago at the Sorbonne by Teddy Roosevelt. It's become one of those popular, whether you call it a speech or a poem or a reading. And it addresses that, look at the men of action, the women of action, look at the people who actually stand up and do things and get dirtied and muddied and beat up by it, because there's a real ethic and there's a real value to that. The number of people who on the sidelines, we call them the peanut gallery, who comment upon it and criticize the men and the women in the arena, there's a lot of those people. And they've got opinions, and they're secondary and tertiary sources, and they're the peanut gallery. But let's never forget the women and men in the arena who are actually making a difference, however you define that. And Roger loved that Teddy Roosevelt quote. He had picked it up actually from Richard Nixon, who wrote a book. And Roger had that poem on his wall his entire life. And so as we made the film, we realized that man in the arena speech by Teddy Roosevelt, the man in the arena is the one who matters, not the critics on the sideline. It really defined Roger's life and his constant achievement and drive over decades and decades. So, what better to call it? It was on his wall. So.
It was perfect, and Roger Ailes was definitely a man in the arena, and now Michael Barnes, you've stepped into the arena. Hopefully you're in there for a long time. Keep the elbows up, and congratulations on the documentary, and good luck with it. I highly recommend it.
Thank you very, very much, and I'm glad you liked the film.
Thank you to Michael Barnes for taking the time. He's out in sunny California, and I'm just here in sweaty East Coast humid hell. I really do recommend the documentary. Go to maninthearena.com. You can link to figure out how to download it or to stream it. It's well worth your time. And if you've got like an Apple TV like I do, it's really easy. It's well worth your time. It's a fascinating story about an incredibly influential man. And it's such an interesting life. So many things I had no idea. My wife worked for Fox News for a couple of years before I met her. And I'd heard some of the stories, but the life story, the backstory about Roger Ailes and how you go from just a kid who wasn't expected to live in middle of nowhere, Ohio, to running the world, essentially, is fascinating. It just lets you know the greatness of America and that anybody, absolutely anybody, can do it. The only limitation on your life is you. All right, keep that in mind. Lastly, the Trump campaign has a special offer just for you. President Trump really wants to give you a signed 2020 Make America Great Again hat. Who wouldn't want that? He wants to make sure the lucky winner is one of his top supporters, so be sure to enter soon because this is an opportunity you don't want to miss. The offer is only going to a select group of supporters, and you are one of them. All you have to do to enter the easiest contest you'll ever enter is text Derek, D-E-R-E-K, to 88022 today for your chance to win a signed 2020 Make America Great Again hat and own a piece of history. Again, that's Derek, D-E-R-E-K, to 88022 to enter to win the contest. Contest to join President Trump in the fight to keep America great for 4 more years. Paid for by Donald J. Trump for President Incorporated. Bust your phone out. Enter now. That is all the time we have. Thank you guys for listening. We'll be back again with another exciting episode tomorrow. Have a happy Tuesday. That much closer to Friday. Thanks for listening.